It's music by Henry Mancini from his soundtrack to the 1967 film Wait Until Dark, which was in turn based on a play from just the previous year by Frederick Knott, by the same name, which happens to be the current production at Parkland Theater, Parkland College in Champaign, and that opens on Thursday. This is Live and Local. I'm Kevin Kelly, and that will be the topic of the first portion of our program today. Coming up, however, a little later on, the topic will be Josephine Baker. There is a new picture book called Josephine with words by a local author named Patricia Ruby Powell. She will be joining me later on in the program today to talk about that book. It's a really interesting kind of book in a lot of different ways, and we'll explore it a bit on the program. But first, it's Wait Until Dark. Dallas Street of Parkland Theater had written me a while ago and asked, do you remember the movie Wait Until Dark? And I said, I don't remember what I said, except that scary as hell, I think, is what what occurred to me. And I saw it many, many years ago. I don't even know when. And it was just for preparation for today, reading the synopsis of the whole thing, and also looking on YouTube at one of the parts of this final scene in the film. And I don't even think I want to go see it anymore. I could deal with it a lot more at the time. And I guess I hadn't realized that the play preceded the movie. Often, it seems like it's the other way around these days. But the play opens on Thursday at Parkland College. We have with us the director of the play, J.W. Morissette, and also four of the actors. In the role of Susie Hendricks is Carol Morisi. In the role of, I guess, sort of the centrally evil character of Harry Rote Jr. and or Sr., Zach Ross. And one of the other crooks who is not the worst of the bad guys, Mike Tallman, is David Kirske. And then in the role of Gloria, Susie's friend and neighbor, Karen Hughes. Thanks all very much for coming on the show today.
Thank you for having us.
J.W., as the director, was this your choice of show for Parkland, or did they come to you and say...
Actually, Joy Hofsummer, who is the artistic director of the Parkland College Theater Program, came to me and asked if I would be interested in working on this show. And 20-some-odd years ago, I had acted in this show. And the minute she mentioned the title, I thought that would be exciting and signed right on. So they came to me, which was great. And I've been really excited to kind of revisit something 20 years later after I had acted to look at it from a director's eye has been really fun.
I haven't seen the stage play, but as I obviously indicated, I've seen the movie. Did the movie precede the play for you?
No. Or the other way around? It was the other way around. I was introduced first to the play, and then instantly, almost within the week, I had seen the movie, which is, as you mentioned before, is the way that it progressed in terms of history. I think it's a really fun contrast. This is one of those pieces that... when we mix film versus the live theater version, each can do something a little bit different and a little more strongly. And having been introduced to it through the theater version first, I adored the fact that, you know, we had Audrey Hepburn was in the – was it Audrey or was it Catherine?
Which one?
It was Audrey. Yes. Every time I
– Quite different.
Yes, quite different. Audrey Hepburn, I love that. And it was actually the first time I recognized Alan Arkin as an actor that I had known of his work, but I was able to associate his name, the 20-year younger me finally recognized that. And I love that they were able to – they capitalize on a really kind of intense psychological thriller in the movie. In the live theater, it plays a little bit more immediate and physical in the space.
For those who don't remember or maybe have never seen either play or I almost said musical, movie, I don't think I'd want to see it.
This would be a challenge as a musical.
Quick synopsis, or at least the gist of what happens is set up for this.
We essentially meet a couple of young newlyweds, Susie and Sam. Susie happens to be blinded via a car accident about 6 months prior, and we... are set in their small basement apartment in New York. And three con artists come together because of a mix-up with a doll that was being brought in via Canada. The doll is full of heroin, and our the leader of our gang of misfits, so to speak, hires both Mike Talman and Sergeant Carlino, as he calls him, to help him run a con on Susie to get the doll back. And as the evening progresses, we realize that Susie is more capable than the con artists had anticipated, and she has a few tricks up her own sleeve as they seek desperately to get this doll full of heroin back. They end up being bested in some ways by our friend Susie.
You mentioned that there are things that one can do on the stage that you can't do in a film and the other way around. And this what little bit I was looking at in YouTube from the film today, it seemed to me that at least that portion of the set almost looked like it could have been the set for a play.
Yes. And it was actually the movie set is almost exactly what's called for in the script. Mm-hmm. They translated that quite well. And because when playwrights structure these thrillers, these intense psychological thrillers, almost murder mystery, although this is less murder mystery. We know who the bad guys are from the get-go. They have such specific needs in how they create the environment of that piece that if you change it, you create major problems for the story to unfold. If the door doesn't do what the door is supposed to do in the script, you have problems. And if you change it for the movie, then the door needs to do something new and the script falls apart if we aren't careful, those kind of things.
Of course, I opened this segment with music from the film soundtrack, and in film, at least American film anyway, there is almost incessantly present music to create a certain atmosphere, to create some of the tension that maybe isn't obvious or might not be obvious from the action. What happens in this play?
It's an interesting question. We're in the middle of the tech sequence, which is where we sit down with the actors and all of the designers in the theater space and start putting lights, sound, and costumes and set all together in some what we call tech rehearsals. And yesterday we were listening to some sound cues that we had anticipated underscoring some of the scenes. And what we realized was it was very cinematic. They were wonderful, but we really wanted silence in the live theater, and that the actors were filling in much of that. So we have sound, mostly for pre-show and in-between scenes, just for some very short transitions and also during the intermission. But within the context of the physical telling of the story, we're letting the actors unfold that story. Mm. And we had a pretty heated debate last night about whether or not we had music during one of the characters' deaths, and we liked what it looked like, but in context of the whole story, it seemed to take away and take us out of that moment, kind of tried to push us a little bit, I think, towards the film instead of being the play that we're doing. So we are currently, as we say, all things can change at any given second. As you mentioned, we don't open until Thursday, but as of now, we have eliminated those internal sound cues, and we're using them more as environmental sound cues, both before the show and during intermission.
And it is only Monday, after all.
Yep.
Well, since you brought the actors, and this is primarily then up to them, I know we've got a couple of scenes to play out here. Why don't you introduce the first one, or someone introduce the first one?
Sure, I guess I could do that.
This is Kara in the starring role.
Well, in this first scene, my husband has just left for the day, and I have discovered that there is something in the apartment that is burning. And because I'm blind, I'm having trouble locating it, and the doorbell rings, so I use this as an opportunity to help deal with this situation.
Mrs. Hendricks.
Oh, good.
My name's Talman.
It's all right. Come in. I think there's something on fire.
Look out. Easy now, okay?
Can you see it anywhere? I'm blind, you see.
I got it. It was only a cigarette, but there was a little paper in the ashtray. Must have caught fire.
Oh, thank you. Where was the ashtray?
On the safe, by the light switch.
Silly of me. I can never quite tell where smoke's coming from. I don't know you, do I?
No, Mrs. Hendricks. My name's Talman, Mike Talman. I used to know Sam.
Oh, I'm Susie Hendricks, but I'm afraid you've just missed him. He won't be back till this evening.
Oh, that's too bad. I'm flying to Phoenix in a couple of hours.
I'm sorry.
I should have phoned, of course. I did try last night, about 9 o'clock, but...
Yes, we were out. Do you often come to New York?
No. Some friends lent me their apartment for a few days. It's quite near here. I thought I saw Sam last night on 8th Street. I was passing in a cab, so I looked him up in the phone book.
Yes, he has a studio near there. Sit down, won't you?
Well, just for a minute, thank you. I see he's still a camera bug.
Yes, he began studying when he left the Marines. Was that where you...
Yes, it was.
You were in the...
The seem so long ago I've almost forgotten. The,
Don't tell me. The 3rd Training Battalion Charlie Company.
That's it. Good old Charlie Company. Did you know Sam in those days?
Oh, no. We first met about a year ago, just after my accident, and got married 6 months later.
You lost your sight in an accident?
Yes, an automobile accident.
Sam and I first met 5 feet underwater, but I guess he's told you that one.
No.
I drove my Jeep into a canal. In fact, I guess he saved my life.
Well, that makes 2 of us.
Oh?
I was practicing how to cross at the lights, and cars were piling up all around me by the time Sam yanked me out, and he wasn't very polite about it either.
Oh, boy, you don't have to tell me.
Were you scared of him?
We all were, till we got to know him, of course. He was just a perfectionist, I guess.
He still is. Of course, he's the one who should have been blind. He'd be terribly good at it.
Blind Sam? I know I shouldn't laugh, Mrs. Hendricks, but...
Oh, that's all right. Now he would be the world's champion blind man. Gloria? Who is that?
It's a little girl.
Come in, Gloria.
She went out. Does Sam still get up to Canada now and then?
Yes, he was visiting his parents there last week. Did you ever meet them?
No, I never did. Well, I'm sure sorry to have missed him, Mrs.
Well,
Hendricks.
Drop us a card next time you're around.
Thank you, Mrs. Hendricks.
Susie.
Well, I better go pick up my bags. Just say hello to Sam for me. Mike Talman. That's right.
Well, goodbye.
So in Mike's case, an actor playing character who's acting.
Yeah.
pretty well at that. So is this quite early in the play?
Yes.
Very. This is the beginning of the con. From here on out, we cannot go back. But this is the very first time they've made direct contact with Susie. Mm-hmm.
And it is from the Parkland Theater production of Wait Until Dark, which opens on Thursday, with Cara Morisi in the role of Susie, and that was David Kiersky in the role of Mike Talman. I guess, Cara, the really obvious question for you is probably gets asked of anybody who has to play a blind person on stage is what sort of preparations do you have to do in order to do that?
Sure. Well, I've had a really great team of people who've been helping me out. I've done a lot of reading about just basic daily skills that people will use to navigate around your apartment safely. So I've learned sort of how to trail my arm around to help locate where I'm at, find furniture, things like that. And as far as acting goes, it's been a real challenge because we really like to make eye contact with each other. That's something that, you know, to act and react, it's so important. So I've really learned how to avoid everyone's eyes. And the stage lighting is really helpful because you can just kind of find a point and locate it and just stay fixed on that and really start to hone in on what you hear versus what you see. So it's been a challenge. Definitely.
Do you do a lot of practicing at home?
I have. I don't know if I've admitted this to anyone. I had recorded the whole script with everyone else's lines, and I would walk around my house with my eyes closed and say my lines with all the blank spaces on my recording. So,
are your kids helpful or a hindrance?
Actually, my oldest daughter has been quite helpful. She's helped me study my lines, so... It's been good.
But are they amused by by mom stumbling around the house?
I think so, and I think at this point they're ready to see the production. It's like, okay, enough of this. Let's see the finished product, Mom. Okay.
How old are your kids?
10 and 12.
Do you recommend it for 10 and 12-year-old kids?
I would say that's an okay age for something like this, but it is pretty scary. I mean, it's the psychological scary. It's not the kind of, you know, gory, icky kind of scary that a lot of kids have probably already seen. But I'd say if they come with parents, then they'll be able to handle it.
And at least this parent has obviously prepared them.
Yes, I have.
they may even find themselves sniggering. I don't know.
Who knows?
From time to time. What's our next scene? This is going to involve everybody here?
Yes. Anybody want to set that scene up? Do you want to do that, Jack?
Sure. The two con men are in the thick of the con, as it were. They are using this scene as an opportunity to... pique Susie's jealousy and her suspicion as part of this con and reveal a little bit of the the context that surrounds the play so that everybody's kind of on the same page. So both Mike and Rote come in and try to set this whole thing in motion.
From Parkland Theater's production of Wait Until Dark, live in our studio here on Live and Local.
Good afternoon. Mr. Hunt.
No, Mr. and Mrs. Hendricks live here.
Hendricks? I beg your pardon. But this is 27B Grogan Street.
Yes, but...
My name is Rote, Harry Rote, Jr. May I ask if an elderly gentleman dropped by today?
Well, I don't know if he dropped by exactly.
Mr. Hendricks, if I may come in for a moment. You see, that was my father.
Yes, come in, please. Oh,
thank you.
Mr. Rote, Mrs. Hendricks is blind.
Oh, I understand. Thank you.
Mike?
Yes, you all right?
Yes, I'm sorry. Mr. Rote?
I'm so very sorry this happened, Mrs. Hendricks. I do hope my father wasn't rude in any way.
Well, now he opened all the drawers in the bedroom. Was that rude, do you think?
Oh, my goodness, but let me reassure you, this is not as serious a matter as you may think, Mr. Hendricks.
My name is Talman. I'm a friend of Mr. Hendricks.
Mr. Talman, my father may appear a little erratic at times, but I assure you he would never...
Harm anyone?
Certainly not.
But he just told Mrs. Hendricks that if...
Gloria?
It's only your groceries. I'll come back later.
Leave them now if you'd like.
What did my father say?
That if somebody didn't leave some woman alone, he would kill him.
Did he mention the name Sam Hunt?
Yes, I think that's what he said.
Oh, then I can explain this all quite easily. You see, my father came here because he thinks your husband is a photographer named Sam Hunt.
Well, as you see, my husband is a photographer, but we can clear all this up right away. Mike, there's a picture of Sam and me on the dresser, a wedding photograph.
I'm afraid that won't help me very much. You see, I've never seen this man.
Well, just who is he, anyway?
About 3 years ago, my wife was on vacation in Montreal, and while she was there, my father tells me, she and this man became acquainted.
So your wife meets some guy 3 years ago, and now your father threatens to kill him? For what?
My father alleges that they have been seeing each other, from time to time, ever since. And now, if you'll excuse me, Mrs. Hendricks, I must find my father.
Mr. Rote, before you go, there's one thing I don't quite understand. How did you get here? Did you follow your father here today?
In a way, yes, I did.
But...
Then you were waiting outside? All the time he was here? Why didn't you stop him?
I didn't follow him here exactly.
Then how exactly did you know this address?
I was hoping not to have to tell you this.
Please, tell us.
I believe my father followed my wife to this apartment.
When?
Last Sunday, my father had invited us to dinner at his club. My wife arrived late and said she couldn't stay because she had to call on a friend who was flying to Montreal the next day, and she had to give him something. Then my father became very testy and wanted to know his name and what it was she had to give him. And she finally became annoyed and said, "Well, if you must know, it's that doll of mine that you broke." Then she got up and walked out.
A doll, did you say?
Yes, it was a musical doll.
Was it?
Yes.
You say Mrs. Rote was going to give a doll to a friend who was going to Canada?
Yes.
Last Monday?
That's right.
Why did she have to do that?
Oh, because this doll wasn't just a toy. It had been specially made for her in Montreal. It played a little tune that was a favorite of hers. So her friend said he would take it back to the makers and have it fixed and then bring it back to her. The moment my wife walked out on us that night, my father said to me, "It's that doll Sam Hunt gave her." Then he followed her. The next morning, I found this note under my door. It just says, "Dear Harry, Sam Hunt lives at 27B Grogan Street in Greenwich Village. Dad." Then this morning, when I told him that Liciana hadn't come home last night.
Who didn't come home last night?
Liciana, my wife. But she frequently comes to Manhattan and decides to stay with friends. She usually phones to say where she is, but so far, we haven't heard anything.
Shall I get it, Susie? Hello? One moment. Susie, it's Sergeant Carlino. He wants to speak to you. Susie?
What does he want?
I must go now, Mrs. Hendricks.
Hello? Could I take a message? No, I'll take it. Hang on a moment. His son is here now. Mr. Rote, don't go. He wants to speak to you.
Who?
The police.
No, say I've gone.
But it's about your wife.
What?
And your father is at the police station.
Hello? Speaking? That's right. No, she didn't, but... Is she hurt? No, tell me now.
Mr. Rote, Mr. Rote!
Mike, don't go!
Of course not. He left the door open. Well, that's some family, the Rotes. The old man just walked into Carlino's office, and it seems that Mrs. Rote has been in some kind of an accident.
She's dead.
What?
She was murdered just outside here last night.
You knew that all the time he was here?
I'd only realized it when he spoke on the phone just now. The sergeant must have told him. It was on the radio. I think they even mentioned her name, but I wasn't listening properly. Mike, could you phone the bus station at Asbury Park and ask them to get Sam to phone me immediately?
Sure I will, but look, you're not worrying about anything that old man is going to say. He's obviously nuts.
But there's something you don't know, Mike. Sam did bring a child's doll back from Canada.
But it can't be the same one.
Exactly like the one he described just now. I was trying to help him unpack, and I must have knocked it off the bed because it played a few notes. So I picked it up and said, "A surprise," or something like that. I thought it was a present for me, but Sam said, he said no, it was for a little girl who was in the hospital. Some woman he'd met at the airport in Montreal had asked him to bring it here for her. Someone he said he'd never met before.
And so Sam took it to the hospital.
No, this woman, it must have been Mrs. Rote. She came here late that night to pick it up, but Sam couldn't find it. And the woman who didn't turn up last night, that was Mrs. Rote, too. They must think that Sam killed her.
Susie.
What?
There's a police car just down the street. They're watching this house.
And there you have a pretty good idea of the setup.
Did you follow that? Because it took me reading this play 5 or 6 times before I understood what the heck was
going on. I didn't
say
that I followed it. I said that was a pretty good idea. No, it's from Wait Until Dark, a play by Frederick Knott that became a film starring Audrey Hepburn and Alan Arkin and Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. And it opens at Parkland Theater on Thursday and will continue through February 23rd, which is the one Sunday that it plays. Otherwise, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, 7:30 performances, and then that matinee on the 23rd at 3 o'clock. Parkland Theater is at Parkland College in Champaign. Our actors are, their actors are, Cara Morisi in the role of Susie Hendricks, David Kiersky, who performed with her second, as Mike Tallman, Zach Ross as Harry Rote Jr. and Sr., and Karen Hughes, who made a briefest cameo in the role of Gloria, and the stage director is J.W. Morissette. There is, by the way, a special dinner for one of the evenings. If you want information about that, go to the website for Parkland Theater, Google it, and you'll get there. And thanks very much to my guests for joining us on Live and Local today, and break a leg, as they say.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
It's Live and Local. I'm Kevin Kelly. Our program is made possible with support from Eastern Rug Gallery, offering over 1,000 contemporary and traditional guaranteed hand-knotted rugs made of pure wool or silk pile. Eastern Rug Gallery also offers a cleaning and repair service. Eastern Rug Gallery, 1402 South Neal Street in Champaign. Stay tuned next for a feature on Josephine Baker, as represented by a new picture book authored by one of our local authors. It's Live and Local. This music by Henry Mancini from a piano rendition of his film music for Wait Until Dark here on Live and Local on FM 90.9. My next guest is the author of a new book called Josephine, representing Josephine Baker. And it just came out this past month, the subtitle, The Dazzling Life of Josephine Baker, with pictures by Christian Robinson. She is Patricia Ruby Powell, who had her own career as a dancer and also now book author, primarily for children's librarian. And how did you, what made you decide to do I guess you could call this a children's book? Should we call this a children's book on Josephine Baker?
Well, it's published as a children's book, but it's an upper elementary picture book, and there are those who think it's for middle school kids, and there are those who think it is for adults. But I wrote it because in my capacity as a substitute librarian at the Urbana Free Library back in 2005, I was working several days through the summer, and we always had a large number of African-American preteen girls who seemed unfocused, and I got to know them, and I thought that a good role model for them would be Josephine Baker. And I didn't know a lot about Josephine Baker at the time. I had been a serious young dancer, and Josephine, I never considered a serious dancer until I became an adult, an advanced adult. And then I started looking at her early footage, and she's so charming. She's so beautiful in the 20s. She was an original. And there's a lot of footage of her. She made 3 movies, all rags to riches, all in French. They're not well known in America because they're French. Juju, Princess Tam Tam, and Sirens of the Tropics. And she is just charming on stage. There's also other footage of her just dancing in her heyday, her early heyday in Paris in the mid-20s and late 20s.
You mentioned that those films, all rags to riches, which is essentially certainly an element of her biography.
Right, exactly. She grew up the poorest of the poor in the slums of St. Louis. And she was so poor that they were the family who had to wrap newspaper around their feet to go out during the wintertime because they didn't even have shoes. They lived in a shack, and they actually moved, the family did, from shack to shack. And everybody slept in the same bed together, the 4 kids, mama and daddy, heads one way, and the children all had their heads the other way. And then she became one of the richest women in the world by the 30s in Paris. She made it big in Paris because America was really too racist to accept a colored superstar back in the 20s and even 30s. She tried to come back to America and make her name here, and it never worked out. She would have successful performances, and then things would go wrong. In the 30s, she was the first African-American, of course, in those days she was called colored, star of the Ziegfeld Follies. And the reviews called her a Negro wench. She was not allowed to walk through the front door of her hotel. She had to go through the back door because she was African-American. And it was so different in Paris. She considered Paris to be colorblind, the French to be colorblind. So she loved Paris. She loved France.
So in spite of the fame she'd achieved over there, did that essentially mean nothing here, that the fame didn't
travel? For years it meant nothing here. She came in the 50s and was a civil rights pioneer before the big-name civil rights workers, before Martin Luther King became known. And she would insist that her audience be a mixture of black and white people, and the black people could not sit in the back. They had to sit interspersed with the white people, and she would not perform until she got her way. She's not the only one who did that, but she was insistent upon that. And she would go to department stores and request that the managers or the CEOs hire black people, not just as janitors, but in roles of authority and also in banks. And she was very effective that way. But things would always go wrong, and she would leave the country with her head down because she was actually this. Not all of this is in the book. Some of it is and some of it isn't. But she was an innocent, and she would do politically naive things. And she would overstep her bounds, and she would annoy people, and she would insist that people come to her aid, and they wouldn't. And she became a big news item when Walter Winchell, would not come to her aid at the Stork Club in New York City. Because she was not served a steak and wine, and her friends were, her white friends were. And she insisted this was a racist slight. And Walter Winchell, who was the great radio personality, would not come to her aid, and she declared that he was racist. And it's questionable, you know, who was right and who was wrong in that. But he was not a nice person. He did not have the reputation for being a pleasant person, and he ruined her name in America for many, many years. But finally she came back in the early 70s when she was in her 60s, and she performed at Carnegie Hall and made a huge splash and got great reviews. But she was 60 years old by then. She was quite an aging dancer, singer at that time.
And had some health problems that eventually did her in, not all that long after, I guess.
Right. You know, she had a wonderful ascension to fame. She was famous all over Europe and in South America and most everywhere except for America. But she adopted 12 children, or I should say, and she adopted 12 children. Mm-hmm. And these were her rainbow tribe. It was an experiment. She thought that people of different races and religions should be able to live in harmony, and she was going to make her family the model of this idea. She moved them into a castle in Les Milandes, and she turned it into a resort, and people could come and observe her family. And she was quite eccentric, and she would have the cows named, because it was also a farm, up in lights. And she couldn't pay her bills. The bills were astounding. And she was not quite as popular as she had once been. And eventually her house was taken from her. And she was evicted, and all her children were evicted. And Grace Kelly, Grace of Monaco, came to her aid and helped her out. And but she was not rich when she died, but she did have a final comeback at the Bobino Theater, where she was a huge, wonderful success. And after the performance, she and her cast went out and had, you know, they partied the way you do after a big opening. She wanted to continue to go to the next plays, and her cast, who were all much younger than she, said, no, 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 we must go home to sleep. And so she went home to bed because there's nobody else to party with, and all her reviews surrounded her on her bed. And just as she was quoted as saying early in her life, I would like to die breathless, spent at the end of a dance, she did.
She did.
She went to sleep in her bed with her reviews surrounding her and never woke up. And she was 71, I think.
And what happened to the kids?
Well, the kids were brought up. They had a father, Joe Bouillon, who was estranged, not divorced from, but estranged from Josephine at the time, because Josephine had promised to adopt 2 children, then 3 children, then 4, but it went all the way up to 12, and it was too much for Joe Bouillon. So he came and took care of the children, and her mother had come to France, and her sister and brother to help her care for the children. And her mother had died by that time, but her sister carried on and helped take care of the children.
I want to come back, of course, to the story, and especially the book called Josephine. My guest this portion of Live and Local, Patricia Ruby Powell, who along with illustrator Christian Robinson has produced this book just out last month. And you are listening to Live and Local. But I wanted to ask you, before this book, is this at all typical of the sorts of books you have produced to date for children?
Well, it's not even typical of most any book for children these days. It's a picture book, and it's 104 pages long, which is very unusual. My other picture books are 32 pages long, which is typical. So Chronicle Books, which is a wonderful publishing company that has, they're really visionary about the books that they put out, thought that they would do a longer picture book with Josephine, maybe 48 pages. Then it became 64. And then they told me it was going to be 104 pages. And I sort of panicked, going, what was this going to cost? And they assured me that it would be a normal price, $17.99. And I calmed back down. And I think it's quite an astoundingly beautiful book. I think Christian's illustrations are remarkable. And he's a new illustrator and making a big splash. And I just met him recently when we did a book event together in San Francisco. And he's a lovely man, African-American man. It was very important that the illustrator be African-American since I'm not. And the book gains credibility by having one African-American maker, and that would be the illustrator and Christian.
Well, we'll talk more about the sort of the attitude of the book in a minute. Let's hear a little bit of Josephine Baker. This is something called La Petite Tonkinoise. What does this come from?
Think Tonkinoise is a Vietnamese person. It wouldn't be politically correct today, but this was back in probably the 30s when it was recorded. And France had that close connection to Vietnam, and they were Tonkinoise.
Tonkin, as in the Gulf of, which was, I think, the scene of the start of the Vietnamese War.
Okay.
If I remember right. Josephine Baker here on Live and Local. Josephine Baker here on Live and Local is called La Petite Tonkinoise here on this discussion about a new picture book by Patricia Ruby Powell and Kristen Robinson. It's called Josephine, The Dazzling Life of Josephine Baker, just out from Chronicle Books. And Patricia, my guest on the show today. Our program's made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, preserving our nation's music heritage at the University of Illinois, now featuring new exhibits entitled On the Road Again, Cruising Coast to Coast with America's Music. More information is available at sousaarchives.org. Of course, you gave a nice kind of overview of the life of Josephine Baker that often got quite serious. You know, she had lots of trials from the very beginning. She had trials at the very end. She had trials in between. But the rhythm, it seems to me, of the book itself is very jazzy, both visually to look at. I mean, there's colors all through the book, just the colors of the pages vary all the time. The illustrations themselves are almost everyone dances in some way or another. And then your text is an interesting mix of what I would call, I guess, sort of a jazzy type of poetry, sometimes fairly explanatory text, and sometimes a mix of the two. Is that a fair characterization?
Yeah, that sounds good. That sounds right.
Which says to me that the biggest focus, in that sense, is the dancing, is the singing, is the art, although you do address in words some of the more serious aspects. How did you approach the topic? Or how did you decide what angle to take, so to speak, in coming up with a text that would appeal to kids, particularly the sort you described at the beginning?
Well, in order to write it, I danced. I tried to channel Josephine, and Josephine was a wild dancer. And I'm not good at sitting still, having been a dancer, you know, all my life. And so I would get up and, as I say, try to channel Josephine, and I think that helped me write Josephine. She was a razzmatazz kind of gal.
And when you, have you shown this book to any of those kids that you were thinking of back at the library?
I don't know those kids any longer. It was a long time ago.
Well, by those kids, was that a particular instance, or is it something?
Oh, it was a particular group of girls who came into the library every day throughout the summer. They were naughty. They were really naughty, and they were unfocused. You know, okay, that was 2005. That was 9 years ago. They're grown up now. I don't know who those girls were. Mm. You know, in the library, you don't tend to know people except by their first names, generally, at least as a substitute librarian.
I was thinking perhaps it was typical of some of girls who might continue to come back as you spend time in the library.
Well, maybe they will find this book. I hope they find this book. I mean, that's part of my idea, my desire for this book is that people of a new generation and of all generations in America know Josephine. Everybody in France knows who Josephine Baker is. Not that many people in America really know who she is. She might just barely be a name that is known to them, many people. And it's time. I think her time has come. Josephine's time has come. I also hope that young readers will read this book and look at it and think in the way that Josephine was fearless or appeared to be fearless and did everything she set out to do. She would invent things to do and do those things. I would like young kids to be inspired to do that. I want to do something, I will do it.
Whatever that may be.
Whatever it may be.
Can we hear some of the book?
Yeah. I'll read from the very beginning. There are quotes interspersed throughout the book which were easy to find because Josephine wrote 5 autobiographies, all in French, and so she said a lot. So the quotes are important. And the first quote opens the book saying, "I shall dance all my life. I would like to die breathless, spent at the end of a dance." She said that in 1927 when she was about 18, 19. Josephine danced a sizzling flapper dance, the Charleston. Knees squeeze, now fly. Heels flap and chop. Arms scissor and splay. Eyes swivel and pop. Josephine, all razzmatazz, erupted into the roaring 20s, a volcano. America wasn't ready for Josephine, the colored superstar. Paris was.
And that's the equivalent of the prologue, I guess.
Right. Exactly. And then it starts in by saying, I'll just read you a little bit of this next page, which explains her beginnings. Josephine, born poor, out of wedlock, in honky-tonk town, rambunctious St. Louis, Missouri, home of barrel houses, nickel shots of whiskey, and gambling halls, home of ragtime music, raggedy black music, gotta make the rent music, lift my soul, golden age music. Josephine's mama scrubbed floors, but would have rather been dancing. Where you were free of how to pay the rent, where you could be right there in your body, nowhere else, where you could let your body laugh or cry.
And that's accompanied to by an illustration from Christian Robinson with young Josephine looking not too happy, scrubbing the floor across from her mom doing the same. Quite colorful. and very, I would say, cartoonish.
Very child-friendly. They have incredible appeal. His first draft, interestingly enough, everybody smiled, and I actually got input into the illustrations, and I would sit and talk to my editor over the phone, and we'd say, well, let's get rid of some of these smiles because not everybody should be happy all the time. But I think the illustrations are absolutely remarkable. The picture of her doing the Charleston in her white dress on a yellow background. I saw the evolution of the illustrations. They went from wonderful to spectacular, and the ones they used were just so great. But all those that preceded were also wonderful. But there she is, the final one that's used for her Charleston dance. Her hips are jetting out one way, her elbows are the other, her beads are flying. It's just so filled with movement.
And she, when she was in some of the early dance lines, made sort of a controversial name for herself amongst her fellow dancers by doing exactly the opposite of what she was supposed to do.
Right. It made the other dancers a little miffed, but the reviewers and the audience thought she was a comic, hysterical, funny. She was. She would mug. She crossed her eyes. She would use her, you know, tongue. Her face was all over the place. And you can find footage online of her, you know, making these faces while she's dancing. And it was part of her persona, her early persona.
And you have referenced several times to her absolutely loving the limelight. When people would laugh and applaud, she couldn't get enough of that.
Right. There's a quote in here where she says, everybody looking at me electrified me. I think it's the picture of Cupid when she's in midair. And, you know, seeing everybody looking at me electrified me. And it was very early in her career with the Dixie Steppers, and they suspended her through the air, and she was supposed to, you know, soar through the air, but her wires got crossed, and she couldn't get down, and she started flailing her legs and circling her eyes and became an immediate success as a comic on stage.
Well, she strikes me as a kind of a curious role model in that very much an attention grabber, very much a contrary sort of person at times. She did the sort of thing that many would have and did call quite unseemly, as in basically she was a stripper of sorts, burlesque sort of stripper, but also quite a wonderful singer and became, I guess, increasingly a more serious dancer.
She took her celebrity very seriously, and she actually had tutors for ballet once she was very famous already to improve her dancing. She was tutored in the French language. She spoke French better than she spoke English because her English was arrested by the time she was about 19 years old and she went to France. But she developed her French and she adored France. France gave her freedom and America did not give her freedom. And as a result, another important episode of her life is she became a spy for the French and worked for the French resistance in World War II. And really did help France and the Allies win the war. She was thought to be a sexy dingbat, and she would go to parties. And she had befriended Mussolini, which is one of her sort of naive acts, perhaps, but it really helped in her role as a spy for France and the USA. She would write down whatever she heard at a party. She would write it in invisible ink and then hide it in her underwear. Or she would just put it on her sheet music and go through from country to country, and nobody would search Josephine Baker to the bone because she was, to the skin, let's say, because she was a celebrity. And she was walking through customs with, you know, parrots and Great Danes and all her exotic animals. She always loved animals and traveled with them, and it was part of her exoticism.
Among them, a pet cheetah.
Yes, exactly.
Her Is it pet true cheetah. That this cheetah would get loose in the orchestra pit?
It happened. It happened. She had to give her cheetah up. Also, her partner at the time, Count Abatino, Pepito Abatino, who they said was a count, but he was really not a count. He was an Italian bricklayer, didn't like Cheetah. And as Cheetah moved from being a kitten, you know, a baby, to an adult, Chiquita began to be dangerous, and she had to give Chiquita up to the zoo. And yes, Chiquita, sometimes Josephine would let the cat out on purpose to arouse attention.
So am I piecing things together right, that one of the things she was famous for early was the banana dance? She named her pet cheetah Chiquita, hence Chiquita Banana?
Good question. I'm not sure of that. I'm not sure. I'll look that up.
I didn't think about that till just now because right. I didn't know the name of the cheetah unless
well,
I missed
Chiquita
it.
Well, Chiquita came after the banana dance because that was the Folie Bergère that she did the banana dance. So Chiquita came later. So it may be.
Well, I have to say that I'm one of those people that had heard the name Josephine Baker. I knew the barest minimum about her. I learned a little bit more just trying to read a little bit so I could talk to you today. But reading your book made me want to find out more about her,
Good.
Which I'm assuming was part of your point.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, she's a wonderful character. And as I said, I didn't get her until I was way into adulthood. You know, she is wonderful. She wasn't just a dancer who danced topless on occasion. She was a wonderful personality.
And fascinating.
And fascinating.
And as I found out, certainly, and you can find lots of YouTube clips.
Right.
Of her. And quite a nice singer.
Yeah. Yeah, not everybody likes her reedy voice, but it's a pretty light voice.
It is, and it's flexible, and it's bright, and uh-huh. You know, as a musician, I quite appreciate it. Patricia Ruby Powell is the author of a book which features pictures by Christian Robinson. It's just out from Chronicle Books, called Josephine, The Dazzling Life of Josephine Baker. You're having a book... What do you call it? Book christening?
a book launch party.
Book
There's
launch
two
party.
Of them, actually.
Okay.
One will take place at Bouvon's February 20th at 6 o'clock.
That's Bouvon's Wine Bar in off of downtown Urbana.
Exactly. Corkscrew and Bouvon's. And traditional jazz orchestra will play the music, which is the kind of music that Josephine mm-hmm. first danced to. And Seaboat will cater it and friends. And I will read from it and teach the Charleston. And Jane Addams Bookstore will sell the book. They're selling it right now in downtown Champaign, Jane Addams Bookstore. And there's an event for families and for children at the Urbana Free Library on March 8th at 10:30. And it will be another... fun event where I will read and tell families about Josephine, and we'll do a little bit of Charleston dancing. And again, the books will be for sale by Jane Addams Bookstore.
Remind me of the dates as we're coming up, and I'll put them on our calendar.
Okay.
We get closer to that, and we'll mention on Live and Local. Thanks very much for joining us on the show today.
Thank you.
Our broadcast is supported in part by 10,000 Villages in downtown Champaign, offering budget-friendly, fairly traded Valentine's Day gift items from jewelry and home decor to chocolate, coffee, and tea. A gift from 10,000 Villages is a gift that gives twice. This is Live and Local on 90.9 WYLL FM and HD Urbana with translator W293 AF Danville, NPR Classical Music, and more for Central Illinois. WYLL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois. Stay tuned in just about a minute for All Things Considered from NPR.